when it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
Events over the past year have shone a light on racial inequality across the globe. Australia is no exception. This nation's journey towards a more just, equitable, and reconciled identity still has a long way to go. With that in mind, and in a spirit of reconciliation, we acknowledge the traditional custodians of country throughout Australia and their connections to land, sea, and community. We pay our respects to elders past, present, and emerging, and extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people today.
I ask the Prime Minister, how good is Australia?
Please explain.
I'm here to make a public statement.
Australia is back on track.
I actually find it gobsmacking.
Just dumbstruck.
I'm going to shirt front, Mr. Putin.
I want to thank that fellow down under.
I don't think, I know.
I have no hesitation.
That should cause great concern.
Just sit down.
I'm sick of your lies.
You're a classic space invader.
A social climbing sycophant.
He needs a mirror.
I mean...
Oh, fair shake of the sauce bottle, mate.
In face of democracy, very good.
Welcome to this episode of Democracy Sausage. I'm Mark Kenny, and of course, the election is only minutes away. Minutes, hours, days, certainly not weeks before the Prime Minister visits the Governor General. He could do so at any time and fire the starter's gun, as they say, for an election, certainly an important one, one I've described as perhaps in socio-political terms as the most important really since 1972. Now, I know a lot of people say these kinds of things. Each election, we're told it's the most important election in a generation or whatever. But I do think there are reasons that might be the case this time, just in terms of the issues, the concerns that are surrounding the current government and the big challenges that governments face, particularly things like climate change, which have not been addressed well by our polity. And there's a great deal of impatience. And I feel that there is a similarity between the kind of impatience that had built up over that long period of conservative rule between 1949 and 1972, an astonishing seven or so, eight maybe even, you know, governments in a row that the coalition ran, most of them by Robert Menzies. But here we are now on the cusp of putting the coalition back in for a fourth term or taking the plunge, which doesn't happen that often, of changing governments. To talk about all of these issues, we have two of the best in the business, Maria Tafflaga from the School of Politics and International Relations here at ANU, who is here each week. Howdy, Maria.
Hello, everyone. Hello, Mark.
And we also have Associate Professor Chris Wallace from the University of Canberra, also a visiting fellow at the ANU and involved in history and political coverage and commentary, and a biographer and a former journalist like myself. And, of course, a regular contributor to Democracy Sausage. Chris, fantastic to have you with us here again.
Hello.
It's an interesting time, isn't it?
It's like being in Darwin waiting for the wet season to arrive. You know, that period of madness.
What do they call it? The build-up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And people start going troppo because they just need it, the new season, to arrive. I think that's a real kind of atmos around Canberra at the minute. Just call the election, please. Yeah. Bring it on. We've got to have this election soon.
It's funny though, isn't it, Maria, that you get this kind of impatience, because this one is particularly well telegraphed. It really has to happen it has to happen in May. It has to happen by May 21, which is a Saturday, the last Saturday in May that it can be called, in order to allow there to be enough time for the new Senate to be counted and take its place, ready for July 1 this year. So the election has to be by that time. And Scott Morrison's left it as long as he can, really. It's either May 14 or May 21. And the very fact that it's so been telegraphed for so long, I think, has really added to that sense of anticipation and impatience.
I think it's quite obvious why it's sort of taken so long. It's because you know, the government has, I suppose, felt that it didn't have the opportunity to go earlier because of the political conditions deteriorating, I guess, in that sort of respectable window where governments can go early for, you know, just norm reasons and obviously strict rule reasons. But the sort of obvious elephant in the room is actually the court judgment that is due this afternoon in relation to whether or not the pre-selections of the New South Wales branch are compliant with administrative law.
The New South Wales branch of the Liberal Party.
That's right, the New South Wales branch of the Liberal Party, yes. And last week there was a sort of odd intervention where there was an attempt, I think, by the Attorney General to potentially appear on behalf or in support of, I suppose, not the complainant, the other person, Scott Morrison's group, basically.
Yeah, they took it to the High Court and they had the Solicitor General very bizarrely appearing in relation to that matter, even though this is an internal party matter. I mean, this is not a government issue. This is the administration of a political party. There's particular legal properties attaching to the conduct of political parties. They are entities that have their own specific set of rights to some extent, although some of those are somewhat ill-defined, and that's what was partly being litigated. But the High Court essentially rejected it and sent it back to the lower court. And
because there were no constitutional dimensions, I believe.
Well, yeah, essentially.
Indeed.
But it was bizarre that I heard Chris Bowen saying this morning, and I suppose we should say, given your reference to this case, that by the time people are listening to this, the outcome of the New South Wales court process, you know, will be known, presumably. But nonetheless, this has been the big dynamic. And as I say, I heard Chris Bowen. Obviously, you might say he would say that, wouldn't he, because he's from the Labor opposition looking to unseat the government. But, you know, he described the involvement of the Solicitor General in this political case before the High Court last week as, you know, saying everything about where the government was, you know, in terms of confusing its identity between, you know, a political party, the government's interest and the national interest, Chris.
Yes, Trump style.
Yeah.
Conflating your own personal interests with the government that you are supposed to be dispassionately running in the interest of the nation.
Yeah.
Absolutely shocking behaviour, but unsurprising, you know, part of a 9-year kind of lost decade for Australia that voters will blow the whistle on or not very soon. The thing, when we look back on this period of the last several months, I think, Mark, that will strike us in retrospect was just how big an opportunity Scott Morrison missed to go early and, whatever the result, get a better result than he will get now. I think in previous Democracy Sausages, when I've irregularly appeared, you know, I've foreshadowed various early-ish election scenarios that Morrison could have followed. And the reason I kept analysing those options was I could see that they would have significant advantages for.
Yeah, there was an apparent logic there, right?
Exactly. Yeah. And you'd have to say that looking at the polls with the retrospective scope on, if he had gone in December last year to the polls, he would have actually had a serious chance of winning. But in mid-March onwards, there was this kind of crystallization of anti-Morrison sentiment outside his party, but more importantly, within his party, that has just got worse and worse and worse for him. I think Anthony Albanese's net approval advantage over him is now about 12 points. And, you know,
So we should just explain that. So the net approval rating is basically the separate ratings, or the approval rating is essentially the separate ratings that the Prime Minister and the opposition leader have. And you arrive at that figure by subtracting the number of detractors from people who view the given leader as doing a good job. And if you're in positive territory, that's a good thing, obviously.
Wherever you're at, if you're ahead of the other fella, you're doing better. And the last three times government has changed hands in Australia, the opposition leader has always been ahead of the losing prime minister in net approval terms.
Right.
So,
which is quite different from better PM, which is that sort of head-to-head thing.
As you know, the pros ignore preferred PM. It's just considered a kind of an interesting but junk metric. But approval and disapproval leading to your net approval calculation is really important. And it is not true that the most popular leader always wins the election. But in the last 11 elections in Australia, the more popular leader has always won. So if government is going to change, that's kind of a box you've got to tick. And Anthony Albanese, as recently as, you know, very late December, very early January, still looked a bit kind of iffy. But from mid-January onwards, there seemed to be this crystallisation, this gear shift in how the Prime Minister and his government were perceived in a very adverse direction. And honestly, the later Morrison has left it to call the election, the worse it's got for him. So a bit like Kevin Rudd in 2000, you know, after Copenhagen.
Yeah, so 2010.
Yeah. The whole Labor Party executive wanted him to call an election.
And indeed, they went into Christmas thinking that the plan was that the Prime Minister would come out of the summer break refreshed, ready to go, and would call an election. Climate change would be, you know, the key, one of the big key things because of the, you know, the Copenhagen debacle. And the Prime Minister didn't do that.
That's right. He spent January 2010 apparently in a bit of a fugue state, you know, not being able to get to grips with what went wrong in Copenhagen. And in February, the election that should have been called in February for March wasn't called. Mm. And of course, by the middle of winter, he fell as Prime Minister.
Yeah, and so there are people who think that those that you know there's a direct sort of causal link between that sequence of events, and that he could have won at that time had he gone. But by the time they were in you know the dark months of July, they decided no, they're going to swap to Julia Gillard.
Well, the Rudd, you know, this is a kind of interesting historical point because people think Julia Gillard was busy running around knifing Kevin Rudd. Far from it. The Labor executive at the time was very much in favour of keeping Rudd in place and wanted him to win another election for Labor before possibly replacing him. And so his leadership was really like a dead branch on a tree that kind of dropped after some backbenchers started running around freaking out about the polling. And of course, Bill Shorten got involved and that was like throwing Kerr on the fire. And of course, the prime ministership fell into Julia Gillard's lap. So I think when we look at Scott Morrison's judgment, political judgment, you know, he's supposed to be this really sharp operator, former state director of the New South Wales division of the Liberal Party, won his miracle election in 2019. But really, this has been a big miscalculation for him. And, you know, are we ever going to get to the election? He's kind of paralysed now because of this New South Wales pre-selection problem. But what if today's court finding doesn't solve the problem? I mean, it's conceivable that he may actually have to call an election without candidates in place. I know that's not going to happen, but it's a theoretical possibility. This is really an extraordinary moment, and his fundamental political craft is really being called into question.
Maria?
Oh, well, I was just going to sort of say, well, he will obviously have to call an election. But yes, as Chris sort of said, potentially without candidates. It's really not quite clear what would even happen depending on which way the court rules, right? You know, or what avenues there are for appeal, because people are so furious that they are sort of saying extraordinary things, right? You know, so there's this court case going on, but then there is also Catherine Cusack, who is a moderate, so not like from the hard right faction like Concetta Ferravanti-Wells. You know, this morning, just sort of, I guess, doubled down on this brutal and frank character assessment of the Prime Minister. She said that she not only endorsed what Concetta Ferravanti-Wells sort of said, her factional enemy, but that she would not be voting for Scott Morrison. And I thought the most devastating thing she said was that even the reason she based this on was because she felt that he and his appointee, Shane Stone, who is in charge of Resilience Australia or Disaster Management, Quango, I've forgotten what it's exactly called, have been sort of playing politics with the funding for disaster relief in the sort of Northern Rivers part of New South Wales. And she sort of said that there was really nothing that he could do. Like, doing the right thing now would not undo the fact that he had done the wrong thing in the past. So that she would not be voting for him under any circumstances. This is, you know, someone who has been part of the Liberal Party as a representative at the New South Wales level for 20 years. Like, this is, you know, we have really strong party discipline in this country. Like, it's I'm trying to convey to listeners that this is not just sort of like you know, an interesting kind of sideshow. This is the breaking down of really strong self-reinforcing norms within a political institution, right? Like, people are so incensed that they are so determined to damage the Prime Minister now because they feel that in doing that they will save their organisation.
Well, that's a really interesting point. I wonder whether, Marie, you see any parallels with, I mean, Chris was just making the point about 2010 and, you know, missed opportunities and so forth, and it's a very valid point, I think. I wonder whether you see any parallels with that period also in terms of people turning on Kevin Rudd and then the internal destabilization of Gillard by pro-Rudd. Rudd himself and by pro-Rudd people during that period as well, that, you know, the Liberals are presumably sitting there watching the government essentially consume itself. And one imagines that's what Labor is doing at the moment. They're sitting around thinking, this is astonishing. I mean, you know, the Prime Minister's character is under assault from right and left within his party. We haven't quite seen, you know, as we've seen on in some of these other meltdowns, you know, actual ministers stepping away and so forth. But that's more associated with leadership challenges than, you know, the sort of weeks leading up to an election. But it's pretty astonishing to see a government kind of, you know, basically falling to bits in terms of its base.
And you'd never know it from the newspapers. I think if I were a Labor MP, I'd be really annoyed at the complete underreporting of this massive story. Labor people often claim there's an asymmetry in reporting, and I think this makes it very visible. If this was the Labor Party, it would be splash party crisis headlines, you know, huge coverage. But instead, you know, the reports are getting tucked away on page 7. Yeah. It's pretty underwhelming performance by the media bosses, I think. I think the journalists are keener to report it than the bosses are. But, you know, do we really only have to have a media that's shaped by Rupert Murdoch, Peter Costello as chairman of Nine Entertainment, and Kerry Stokes? I mean,
apparently.
God, not good.
What do you think, Marie? I mean, it is pretty astonishing to see the Liberal Party in this state, because it's sort of like they've put a guy in there who, as Sean Kelly points out, has been very good at, up until relatively recently, at kind of writing his own story, but he's lost control of that narrative, and people are coming out of the woodwork on either side within his party and making the most, you know, frank assessments, which go to his, you know, fundamental aspects of his character, his integrity.
Yeah, well, I mean, this is the thing, I guess, you know you got to think about when you're thinking about these kinds of internal dimensions, and that is people who are party members and who essentially join a party, see the factional warfare that is, you know, a bread and butter of the New South Wales division, right? No one who is a member of the Liberal Party for more than 5 minutes doesn't understand this. So those who have chosen to stay are essentially signing up for this kind of conflict. What is the biggest sin, really, is to not believe in anything. And that is one of the key criticisms that is constantly leveled at Scott Morrison internally within the coalition, that, you know, that he doesn't believe in anything. And so, yes, he may have been sort of installed or supported by the moderate faction, in effect, with the support of the centre-right, the Alex Hawke centre-right, you know, as a bulwark against Dutton. But, you know, he's never really had the sort of enthusiastic support of the moderates. You know, and at one point, Scott Morrison was very famously, there's a famous story about him showing up to both factional dinners on the same night.
Yeah,
but the
that's right, yeah.
The far right, yeah, they absolutely hate him because he did out their candidate. You know, they think he also had a hand in destroying Abbott. And even though, you know, on policy terms, his personal preferences seem to align far more with the right, the far right rather, than the moderates, you know, he has never really proven himself to be of that faction either. And there's a sort of two-level game going on here, right? By that, there's the implications for the state government and Dominic Perrottet, right, who is a member of the far right. And then there's, you know, Scott Morrison, who is in charge at the federal kind of level. And there's currently, like, there's a big interaction kind of going on around these pre-selections, because in some cases, Morrison wanted people from state seats to move to the federal election to help him win seats like Hughes, for example. But Dominic Perrottet obviously didn't want to see any more by-elections, and so that's one of the reasons why that deal was made, to basically kind of cut out Connie. But you actually asked me a slightly different question. I got distracted. I apologize. So the answer to your actual question, Mark, is I do wonder what the average voter thinks about this sort of inter-sign war. Like, I was thinking about what you said about Kevin Rudd and when his colleagues kind of came out and eviscerated him. It didn't really seem to do anything or any major damage to Rudd's public standing with everyday kind of voters who were sort of only marginally or, you know, relatively uninterested in the everyday happenings of politics. But I think the difference there was that, you know, Rudd was someone who was perceived to be very bright, to have ideas, who wanted to do stuff, who was clearly trying, right, but stumbled over climate change and kind of failed to live up to his own rhetoric. I don't think the public sees Scott Morrison in the same light. And so these sort of internal character assessments from his closest sort of, I guess, colleagues and the sort of long, I guess, ghosts of his past, I think they might play out kind of differently. But even so, you know, we like to kind of talk about this sort of like all inside baseball kind of beltway stuff. Well, look, when it comes down to it, you know, we elect political elites to do a job for us, and that is to govern the country. And we also rely on the media, another form of political elite, to keep them honest. So even if this is perhaps not of interest to voters, it is actually really important to the political system that these kinds of, I guess, claims about the Prime Minister and his conduct are actually properly, I guess, ventilated. And I think Michael Twoke will appear on the project tonight, so it will add fuel to the fire.
Well, we'll talk more about that in just a moment. We'll go to a break now and come back in a sec.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
Hi, I'm Sharon Bessel. Policy Forum Pod is the podcast for those who want to dig a little deeper into the policy challenges facing Australia and its region. Each week, we bring together expert analysis to tackle the big issues facing our region and to propose policy solutions. It's insightful, it's positive, and it's always fun. Policy Forum Pod is out every Friday. You can find it on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your pods. Or find us at policyforum.net/podcasts.
Welcome back. Now, you were mentioning Michael Twoke. Before we go to perhaps some more specific discussion of that, because it does, you know, obviously fit into the pattern of what we've been covering anyway, but I just wonder whether there is a parallel, and I'll get both your quick responses on this, whether there is a parallel between Morrison and Rudd in the sense that, and Turnbull to a degree as well, that is, these are leaders that are essentially there because they can win. I mean, Morrison wasn't exactly loved by his party room at the time that he came up the middle of that race between Turnbull and Dutton in 2018. But Morrison was the winner, and in the end he was the winner because the calculation was made that they could win with him, and or at least some people thought that he would save the furniture. At least I think at that stage they didn't even think they could probably win the next election. Such was the blood on the floor from that whole leadership stoush. But certainly Labor went to Rudd in late 2006, I think it was, with the view to winning an election. The Liberals held their nose and voted for Malcolm Turnbull when they did do it, when they knocked off Abbott for the same reason. And it's when they don't look like they're going to win, that's when the supporters start to, you know, dropping like scales, I suppose.
Well, this really striking thing about the current situation is that the coalition has gone to the last three elections each time with a different leader,
yeah.
Each one covered in the blood of their predecessor, and won.
Yeah.
But not this time.
Yeah, that's right. This time they're going with someone who actually won last time and is still there. First person who's done that since John Howard in 2004 to 2007.
And what was the lesson of the John Howard prime ministership? They should have got rid of him.
They should have got
rid of him. Before the 2007 election, gone to Peter Costello, the heir apparent,
yeah,
who quite possibly could have beaten Kevin Rudd.
Yeah.
And had that happened, of course, the carbon pricing system that John Howard had promised at the 2007 election might have happened.
Yeah, it's an amazing sort of what-if moment, sliding doors moment, the whole lot of different things.
Exactly.
We wouldn't have had the intense politicisation of that issue that Tony Abbott brought to it when he knocked off Malcolm Turnbull at the end of 2009, took over the leadership, turned the opposition into a high-impact, non-cooperative process, shook the Labor government to the core. By 2010, Labor had axed its successful prime minister, put Julia Gillard in, she wins. What'd she get? 72 seats and the coalition got 72 seats in that election. Then you have the negotiation. Gillard leads a minority government. Abbott, again, the high impact operator, and gets vindicated, wins 90 seats.
Well, we think
Labor's
of Abbott,
55 in 2013.
We think of Abbott as a very high impact operator, and he was certainly a nasty operator. But people forget that his job was so much easier as opposition leader because Kevin Rudd's allies were running a reign of terror internally in the Labor government against the Prime Minister, a completely disgraceful episode in Labor history.
Mm.
But I've got to say, in terms of the Liberal Party breaking its habitual behaviour of shunting unpopular leaders who look like they're going to lose an election and replacing them with some fresh meat that voters haven't got a bead on yet, so voters then give them...
That's so well put, because that's actually what... That was actually the trick that Morrison really achieved. And this is the line I've been sort of, a point I've made in some analysis around the place, is that Morrison's strength in 2019 is his weakness now. That is, his strength in 2019 was that voters didn't know him. He's a bit of a marketing expert. So voters didn't know him in 2019, which was an advantage. In 2022, they do know him and it's a disadvantage. But the Libs picked almost, if we go with your point, Chris, and it's a really interesting one, the Libs picked the wrong time to suddenly, you know, get principle and stick with their leader. They may have stuck with someone who can't take them over the line. You can take
him
over
the
cliff.
Well, it's the rules. The rules. The rules make it hard to replace him.
That's complete bollocks. The rules can be changed by a simple party room vote anytime they want to do so.
Yeah.
The other thing is there's a precedent.
Sorry, Chris, can I just make a point on that? Because I hear people say that, and that's true, but that vote would be tantamount to a leadership moment at that time, right?
So that's right.
So, yes, you can do it.
That's right.
But you
yes,
can't
you can
pretend that it's just a procedural.
You've got the important part of it.
No, but you can't.
Yes,
just,
that's right. Look,
no, it would be
you
freighted
are old enough
with
to
all
remember,
of that.
You are old enough to remember John Howard losing the leadership in 1989 as opposition leader.
Regrettably.
Do you
regrettably
recall how that
enough,
happened?
That
now, Maria probably wasn't born, so let's fill
no,
her
but
in.
She's more of an expert on the Liberal Party than I am.
She's a political scientist, so her history sometimes isn't as good as her political science. And she couldn't be expected to know this, but it's a fascinating example of the range of
I'll
ways you can do in
that,
a leader.
Maria.
So in 1989, in May, I think it was four, but it was at least three or four Liberals walked into John Howard's opposition leader's office and said, "It's up."
Yeah, this is Wilson Tuckey and co, wasn't it?
It was Fred Chaney, Peter Shack, John Moore, and Wilson Tuckey.
Yeah.
And one of them had in their pocket a folded piece of A4 paper with the names of every Liberal member who had pledged to vote against Howard in a leadership vote.
Yeah. But right? Let's bear in mind they're in opposition. They're not in government at this point.
Doesn't make any difference. Look, I game this all the time. My great fear is that Scott Morrison won't be leading the Liberals at the next election. I think voters have an absolute right to cast their vote and judge his government at the coming election. So I fervently hope he remains Prime Minister at that poll on election day and, you know, accepts the judgment of the people. And I think that would be a lot healthier for the Liberal Party too, because if he loses, it's a clear signal to go. Whereas if he's replaced before the election in a coup, he could hang around like a bad smell, like certain other former opposition leaders and prime ministers, causing problems. So I really hope that happens.
Well, including John Howard, who goes on to be a dozen-year prime minister.
But all it would take to finish the scenario, all it would take is for Josh Frydenberg and Peter Dutton, the two most likely successors of Scott Morrison, to have a cup of tea and say this to each other. "We don't know which one of us would win in a leadership contest, but we both know that we will do better for the coalition vote as Prime Minister going to this election than Scott Morrison would, who because he is an expired franchise. He is less popular than Anthony Albanese," right?
Mm.
That means a lot in the Liberal Party. So if they simply had a cup of tea and said, for the good of the party and to save colleagues who would otherwise be unemployed after the election, you and I should combine to call it on, have a vote. We don't know who's going to win. May the best person win. Let's go for it.
You know why that won't happen? Because Scott Morrison will refuse to show up to any such meeting.
That wouldn't stop it happening, Maria.
There is no sitting, right, to bring them all together. And those that don't want to see
again, I hate to play the I'm really old card, but I've seen party room meetings for just this purpose arranged out of sitting periods. There's a whole lot of myths about why it won't happen. Now, I actually don't think it will happen, and I'm pleased that it probably won't happen. One of the reasons it's less likely than more likely to happen is because there's yet another option, and it is this. I don't know if you saw Zali Steggall on Qantas the other night.
I did, yeah.
Right, so you'd be aware of her comments where she said it was an open possibility that her position could be influenced by who was coalition leader during negotiations over who to support as a minority government should neither side of politics get a majority. Now, that was signalling that she may support a minority coalition government providing Scott Morrison isn't leader. So let's go through a possible scenario here. Neither side gets a majority. The negotiations begin. So Anthony Albanese would be negotiating and someone, the Liberal leader, would be negotiating. Now, if Scott lost the election, it's very likely that Josh or Peter Dutton would be leader. Let's say it's Josh, more moderate face. So it would be Anthony Albanese negotiating and Josh Frydenberg negotiating, saying, look, we've cleaned out to people like Zali and other independent MPs. We've cleaned out the problem. The problem was Morrison. You know, I, Josh Frydenberg, am a more contemporary person, more mainstream values, happy to do more on climate, happy to meet you somewhat halfway on Integrity Commission. I'm obviously a much better person on gender than my predecessor. Zali Steggall could well support a minority coalition government led by Prime Minister Josh Frydenberg in that situation. She probably wouldn't be alone amongst independent MPs going in that direction, providing they could bargain enough from a new coalition leader who looked more moderate. You know, people aren't considering this factor, but the Liberals are very alive to it. Josh Frydenberg is particularly alive to it. Much easier to become the new Liberal leader if Scott Morrison loses the election and fails. But it's not like Frydenberg would necessarily be facing opposition leadership in that scenario. He may be able to bargain support for a minority coalition government. And you know what, Mark? That would make it two miracle coalition wins in a row.
Yeah. Maria, do you want to respond to that?
It's very interesting in terms of speculation. I don't really know if I have much more to add to it. I mean, I think we actually have to get through the campaign. I saw a very interesting figure in the polling put out by the Herald today, which I thought was not the best news for the government, but also sort of signaled, I think, how difficult politics will become no matter who wins, which was that 50% of people thought the budget would be good for the country, which is interesting given some of the sort of economically focused coverage of this budget has pointed to its inflationary risks and the fact that it is not really very big on a future agenda. So 50% thought it was good for the country and 40%, only 40% thought it was good for them. So that bit is not so great for the government. And the 50%
thing, but they're all tradies and they'll probably support the government as a result of, you know, I mean, the government only actually thinks jobs involve, you know, people wearing hard hats and high vis and driving massive utes. They're the only real jobs, apparently. So that we see that imagery all the time and that's what the budget's attuned to. But I think, you know, you make a very good point. I think I'd probably say about that sort of polling that it's really what, you know, you can sort of look at it about eight different ways, but
oh yeah, absolutely.
I mean, 50% of people think the budget's good. I think the way to look at it, right, is 50% of people think the budget's good for the economy, and really, it created no losers. I mean, it was a pre-election, it was a purely political budget before an election, designed to create no class of specific losers. No one had, you know, there were no cuts that you would expect a coalition government to be doing in terms of fiscal consolidation. Remember when Josh Frydenberg told us that when unemployment was comfortably below 5%, you know, fiscal consolidation or budget repair could start and it wouldn't start before then. Well, now we've got a budget that's forecasting unemployment at 3.75% later this year and perhaps 3.5%. And yet the government is still not doing it. Of course it's not doing it because it faces an election. So I'm not that surprised that people think it'll be good for the economy. They're not most people aren't economists and they're not really that tuned into the sort of economic arguments about stimulus and
the relationship
with that and possible inflation.
And well, I think no one's really been sort of. That would be a challenge.
We're not having a
discussion around the fact that we are already in difficult times, and it's not like it's going to get any easier.
No, that's true. I think that's one of the confusing things about the budget, just quickly, was that it sort of argued two contradictory strands. At one level, we're the government, we've got the economy, we've got this ebullient economy, better than anywhere else in the world. We're fantastic, everything's great, we're in the recovery phase, and we're growing strongly. At another level, it's saying, look, things are sort of unstable, there's a great deal of uncertainty around, people are suffering, here's some emergency payments with some borrowed money. Which is it? People aren't going to get too finicky about that because, you know, people will take those handouts. Welfare recipients will get the $250 and others will get the addition to their low and middle income tax offset after the election. But, you know, people will probably budget that and they'll be happy for it. But will it change their vote? I don't know.
The budget was junk policy in a long line of very poor policy from this government. It produced an amazing media consensus, which I can't remember over any other budget. Now, of course, the usual suspects said the things you predict, though fairly wittily. Greg Jericho in The Guardian, who's an excellent economic analyst, said it showed the government in its death throes.
Mm.
Anthony Albanese showed it. The budget had all the sincerity of a fake tan. I thought that
might be before waving it through.
But remarkably, the journalist closest to the Prime Minister, Phil Khoury, nicknamed the stenographer, and it's very helpful because you can always get a kind of direct download of what Scott's thinking at any moment by reading Phil's Friday columns. I never miss them. They're great. He said that the budget was delivered on Tuesday night and had evaporated by Wednesday night. Now, that's the most government-friendly journalist in the press gallery's judgment of the budget. That is dire.
I would probably quibble with most government-friendly journalist in the press gallery, but I think the general point is right. And I might even go further and say it evaporated on Tuesday night when Conchetta Fiorenti-Wells stood up and basically, you know, rejigged the political news agenda by her excoriating assessment of the Prime Minister. What I want to do, just in the time we've got remaining, in only a few minutes, I suppose, but is just talk about the other possibility. I mean, you know, what we've covered here is a number of things that have gone wrong for the government, a number of mistakes that in judgment the Prime Minister's made. We've talked about the assessments of the Prime Minister's character, which can't have helped and which may presumably have a lot of Liberals very worried about why they've stuck with this guy. It's also possible that he can win. He didn't look like he could win in 2019. He might be about to do it again. The polls could close up a bit. There could be some contest. There may be events, of course, that could happen in this election campaign that we haven't even imagined. External events or some sort of big mistake made by Labor in its costings or, you know, things have happened in elections that do change their trajectory a bit. What's your assessment of that overall situation, Maria? Do you think Morrison can actually pull this out of the fire? I mean, theoretically, I'm not asking you whether he will, but whether he can.
I do. And this is the reason why I think that it's still a live possibility. And that is the way the vote is distributed across the country really matters, right? It's not enough to win a majority of votes. Plenty of Labor opposition leaders have actually managed that achievement. So did Andrew Peacock in 1990, didn't he? What really matters is the distribution of that vote. And it's not necessarily clear to me that the vote will necessarily flow in all kinds of seats. I think the government is in serious trouble. I think that Labor actually does have a chance of pulling off a majority government. I don't think I would have said that in January. I would have bet on a hung parliament. So I think the situation has drastically deteriorated. But I do also think that this is an unusual time. It might be one of the few times a campaign actually matters. That you know, according to the empirical evidence, they don't tend to matter too much. But it really might come down to, frankly, how the seats kind of fall. I do think the stuff in New South Wales is deeply damaging for the government because that's kind of where they were hoping to retain government.
Yeah, they were hoping to sort of make up for losses that they expect to take elsewhere. I mean, there's the most optimistic terms of Labor's gains in WA, for example, seem to be around 5 seats, more likely as I think 2 and possibly 3. I'm thinking of Pearce, which is Christian Porter's old seat, and Swan, Steve Irons retiring there as well. Both of those seats I think Labor feels has a very good chance of getting. We know, of course, the Liberal brand in WA is utterly shredded. Although Mark McGowan was, you know, playing happy friendlies with Prime Minister recently, much more so than he does with Anthony Albanese, interestingly. And in fact, it was fascinating, Chris, you and I being originally from Adelaide, there was the PM over there in WA, glade handing it with Mark McGowan, having flown straight over the top of South Australia, which was in election frenzy and where the government went over a cliff. And they didn't really want to see Morrison because the things were bad enough already.
That's true.
There's a couple of seats, maybe 3, maybe 4, that could fall in from the government in WA and sort of game over, right? And there's Queensland, there's 30 seats there. Labor holds 6 of them, I think. That may remain static as well. The Libs think they've got a chance in Lingiari. Some even mentioned Solomon in both of those in Northern Territory. I think both of them are probably out of their reach. We hear about Boothby in South Australia at every election, but it's on a very wafer-thin margin. I think it's 1.4%. So that's a possible Liberal loss there. Victoria, Chisholm presumably goes back to Labor. There's one or two others, and, of course, the role of the independents as well. And then you get to New South Wales. Well, I suppose Libs also think they might have a chance of getting Lyons back in in Tasmania. But, again, I'm not entirely sure whether that's being optimistic. But you get to New South Wales, and that's where they're hoping to essentially, you know, protect their net position. And you've got seats like Eden Monaro where they haven't had a candidate on the ground until the very last minute and a few others.
Yeah, it's true. And I think given the experiences of the last few elections, people are notably reluctant to kind of get out of a defensive posture and go, yeah, Labor's going to win, right? And I'd include myself amongst those analysts. You know, there's a lot of gun shyness around about calling it. And, of course, we've got to be really cautious. Campaigns are so important. All the polls are telling us now is what kind of result there would be likely if the election was held this Saturday.
Yeah, it's not predictive.
And the election, exactly. It's the, you know, a progress score halfway through the fourth quarter. So we need to be really cautious. If I was putting $100 on it now, I would bet on a solid Labor win. With this caveat, if you look at news poll, Labor's primary vote fell to 38% in the latest survey, even though it's on a strong two-party preferred result. 38% primary is what Julia Gillard got in 2010.
Yeah. They want that primary vote in the 40-plus range to be genuinely
confident. And it has been recently.
It's been
as high as 41. So it could be just noise in the survey, you know, something to keep a close eye on.
Yeah, or just a bit of a budget ripple that disappears. Yeah.
But I tell you, Mark, the moment when I really fundamentally reassessed how I was analysing things and what I was, you know, personally forecasting in my own little scon, and it was a senior New South Wales Liberal, a very senior New South Wales Liberal, who said to me, oh, Labor's going to cream Morrison. And I said, what do you mean? And they said, it's simple. Unless in New South Wales enough seats are won to offset the losses elsewhere, we are done. And this person went on to say, you know, take a look at the New South Wales division. It is on fire. It is a complete wreck. There is no way, against the backdrop of this infighting, that Morrison is going to be able to pick up enough seats in New South Wales to offset losses elsewhere.
Yeah, and it's not just the infighting, like the stories about it, but it's the inability to actually have candidates on the ground doing things. And the fact that the Libs are going to be spread so thin, defending safe seats in some cases against these very credible independents.
That's true.
Fighting off the hard right, the populist right in Queensland, Hanson and
Palmer. They can't even print the call flutes in a number of key seats. This is just extraordinary.
That's right. And they're knee deep in bad blood, you know, there. So, and look, final comment on this, right? It is astonishing to think that someone who used to be the director of the New South Wales division of the Liberal Party and who has risen to be Prime Minister to the very top has so little clout, so little organisational control, so little prowess at negotiations and so little sort of front-footedness about the addressing of problems. And we've seen this with a range of policy areas throughout his prime ministership. He's the one who holds the timing of the election in his hand, and yet his own division is in this bitter internecine fight.
Well, and right to up, be fair, right he created this situation.
Well, yeah, and he's been instrumental in creating it.
But you know, when it comes down to it, it's all about Scott Morrison and Alex Hawke. And I think one of the big stories that I hope journalists pursue after the election is what was so important about saving Alex Hawke's pre-selection to Scott Morrison that he was prepared to blow up the entire New South Wales division and possibly cruel his re-election as Prime Minister in order to save Alex Hawke. What is going on there? It is fascinating.
Well, it goes to his maintaining control and his primacy in that electorate. And I guess my final word would be, it is interesting to me that all of his strengths ultimately relate to his machine man persona, and that a bit like Bill Shorten, he seems to have struggled to move beyond the machine and into the prime ministership, a la someone like Bob Hawke.
Yeah, and yet even the machine part of it's not been particularly adept, one would have thought, as I was just saying. Look, thanks. That's been a terrific discussion. We could keep talking about this for a long time, and we're going to be talking about it a lot for the next few weeks. And I think maybe, Chris, it depends obviously on the result, but you're right about that that sense of wariness that people have in looking at what constitutes empirical data in front of us, albeit not predictive. People will look back and say, of course that result happened. The evidence was there, but 2019 has made a lot of people very hesitant about making any sort of predictions. I think it probably extends to the commentariat. It certainly extends to people in, the parliamentarians themselves. So there are many things that will happen between now and then, including some debates. If someone bombs very badly in debate. Debates don't usually turn things as much as people who cover them expect them to, but I guess a very bad performance, a key mistake, who knows? Things could happen. Things can change. That's why you have election campaigns, I guess. So we're going to watch this one very closely here on Democracy Sausage. That's it from us. Thank you, Chris, for your contribution.
Pleasure.
And Maria, once again, always good.
Yeah.
And as I say, that's it for Democracy Sausage this week. We'll look forward to talking to you again next week when we'll do it all again. Bye for now.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com. The number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.